The Oracle Network.
Look deeper. Well, hi there, friends, and welcome back. I'm your host, Melanie Peterson, and today's case infuriates me to absolutely no end for several reasons. This killer is a predator, he is a rapist, he is a murderer, and he did all of this while serving in the Canadian Air Force. He is none other than the Tweed Creeper David Russell Williams, a former Canadian Air Force colonel who caught the entire military community off guard when he was arrested in February 2010. He even flew the Queen of England from London to Canada and back again in 2005, and also received a personalized, autographed photograph from the Queen, thanking him for his illustrious service. Prior to his arrest for the murders of Marie-France Comeau and Jessica Lloyd, Russell was responsible for dozens of break-ins, often posing for photographs while wearing the undergarments of the young girls and women who lived in the homes, and then he would steal them as a memento. He also broke into the homes of several victims, attacking and sexually assaulting them before escaping into the night, never being identified because he would blindfold them. After he was arrested and convicted, the Canadian Armed Forces burned his entire military uniform kit, including his boots, in a furnace at Base Trenton, where he served as the base commander at the time of his arrest. The unprecedented act was what one spokesperson called the act of, quote, exercising the memory of Russell Williams, end quote. Buckle up, my friends. This one is going to be a bumpy ride. This is Mask of Sanity. Before David Russell Williams was arrested for terrorizing the community of Tweed, Ontario, Canada, he spent 23 years in the Canadian Forces and was what many military members considered an exemplary leader. Russell was born on March 7, 1963 in Bromsgrove, Worcestershire, England. He spent the first 5 years in England before his family moved to Canada, and shortly after the move, his parents divorced when his mother, Christine Williams, discovered that his father was having an affair. The divorce was finalized in October 1969, and Christine got custody of both Russell and his brother. She eventually remarried and changed her name to Noni when Russell was 7. She married Jerry Sovka, and a few years later, in May 1975, they relocated to Scarborough Bluffs, and Russell would actually end up adopting Sovka's last name, going by Russ Sovka, when he entered high school at Birchmount Park Collegiate Institute in 1978. The following year, Jerry Sovka, a nuclear engineer, received a job opportunity in Busan, South Korea, so the whole family was uprooted for a time, but some reports actually have Russell staying behind to finish high school, others have him traveling with the family, so it's a bit unclear there. In 1980, Russell and his brother Harvey, who moved back to Toronto, began attending Upper Canada College. It's an elite boarding school for boys. His academic career was pretty normal. He graduated from UCC and went on to earn a degree in economics and political science from the University of Toronto. Just before he graduated from UCC, there was actually a rape reported on campus, but there's no indication that Russell was involved or had anything to do with it. In 1987, David Russell Sovka entered the Canadian Air Force. He completed his basic training at Moose Jaw and then afterwards was stationed at Chilliwack in British Columbia. When he began his military career, he reverted back to using his given name of Williams. And less than a year into his time in the military, Williams is suspected of committing his first murder, that of 21-year-old Margaret McWilliam. Unfortunately, the case remains unsolved, but her body was found beaten, raped, and strangled just 3 miles from where Williams was living at the time. Eventually, Williams met and married Mary Elizabeth Harriman on June 1, 1991, at the Winnipeg Art Gallery in Manitoba. Over the next few years, he began to gain attention for his outstanding military service. He flew in air shows. He piloted the CC-144 Challenger, which, if you're into military aircraft, it's primarily used as a transport plane to escort high-ranking officials such as the Prime Minister and Queen Elizabeth II. By 1994, he became well known for flying VIPs on behalf of the Canadian Air Force as he worked his way up in rank. In 1995, he and his wife bought a house in Orleans, just outside of Ottawa. At this point, there is nothing in his behavior that would indicate that he was actually capable of the horrific acts that would occur in the next decade. Without extensive active combat service at this point in 2003, it's noted that a thesis he wrote while working on a military graduate degree contained nothing very original in terms of the war in Iraq. He hadn't deployed to Iraq, based on my research. He only had a tour of duty for about 6 months in the Persian Gulf in 2005. So it seems like he almost wrote the paper to check a box to graduate from this course in order to be eligible for promotion, which, for all of my fellow military friends out there who know, professional military education is a big part of promotion eligibility. Just 8 months after completing this graduate degree, Williams was promoted to Lieutenant Colonel and assigned to the 437 Transport Squadron at Canadian Forces Base Trenton as a squadron commander. He continued to fly notable dignitaries around, including Queen Elizabeth II, also Prince Philip, and the Duke of Edinburgh in early 2005. And this is when the Queen reportedly gave Williams an autographed photograph as a thank you for his years of service. All right, my friends, sit tight. I'm going to take a short break. I'll be back in just a minute. Okay, friends, welcome back. After Hurricane Katrina devastated New Orleans and the surrounding states in 2005, Williams was actually part of the Canadian relief effort and flew Red Cross personnel as well as much-needed supplies to the Gulf of Mexico. 2005 was quite a busy year for Williams. After his Katrina assignment, this is when he served 6 months as commander of Camp Mirage, located in Dubai, and during this deployment, one of his future victims, Corporal Marie-France Comeau, served under his command. Upon his return, Williams, quote, gave up the command of his squadron. He was then assigned to Ottawa to oversee new aircraft projects, end quote. His new position was as the Directorate of Air Requirements, and it was no secret that Williams was being groomed for even bigger positions within the Canadian Air Force, and possibly beyond that. About a year after he began his position as directorate, Williams committed his first burglary. On September 28, 2007, he broke into his, quote, neighbor's house and put on a pair of their 12-year-old daughter's underwear. He took pictures of himself and ejaculated. He stole 6 pairs of the girl's underwear. He made at least 2, possibly 3, visits in September, end quote. It was later discovered after his arrest that Williams was actually responsible for 79 break-ins during the month of September in 2007. Most of the homes were near where he lived, and all included the theft of undergarments of victims ranging from adolescent girls to adult women. By November, 45-year-old Williams committed one more home invasion and then stopped until March 15, 2008, with police noting that the break-ins all shared similarities and were possibly the work of the same man. Williams would either enter the home through an unlocked door, or cut a hole in a screen, or open a window, or pick a lock. Rarely were any of the victims home when he broke in. By October 31st, 2008, police issued a warning to residents about the break-ins, calling this unknown person the Tweed Creeper. They urged people to be vigilant and keep an eye out for any suspicious activity. Despite Williams no doubt knowing about the warning, he didn't show any signs of slowing down. In January 2009, he made, quote, his biggest lingerie and undergarment haul yet, 186 items, end quote. Also, What Williams stupidly, in my opinion, did was document his break-ins and store the photographs of himself in the undergarments on his computer. He apparently had an affinity for documenting things on the computer. He even wrote a note on one of the victim's computers to the victim, thanking them for allowing him to come in. Unfortunately, in a lot of the homes that Williams entered, the victims didn't realize that they had been burglarized, so they didn't notice the missing undergarments right away. But, I mean, honestly, I get that. A sock goes missing, you misplace a bra or a pair of underwear, you lose something at the laundromat, it happens. It doesn't necessarily mean that someone stole them. Except in this case, that's exactly what happened. As the break-ins kept happening, police, including Detective Sergeant Jim Van Allen, who was a criminal profiler with the Ontario Provincial Police, were concerned that the person responsible was becoming more aggressive, with a bigger potential for escalation to possibly even actual physical assault, because he had been able to evade capture so far. Williams broke into the home of a woman on July 10th, 2009, and she was home. She was taking a shower as Williams slinked through the home. Reports show that he stole a black thong, but also he confessed to walking around naked in her home. Knowing that someone was home and he still continued with the burglary and even found time to remove his clothing and walk around without a care in the world, this, I believe, indicates that not only was he not at all concerned about what would happen if she caught him, but he was absolutely doing what Detective Van Allen said and escalating his behavior. During this particular break-in, he didn't stay long enough to take any photographs of himself, but again, the fact that he was there when the person living in the home was home and still took off his clothes, still stole undergarments, is definitely an argument for escalation. Just 5 days after this burglary, Williams assumed command of the 8th Wing at Base Trenton, where he was previously a squadron commander. Over the next 2 months, he attacked at least 2 women and broke into several homes. On September 17, 2009, he sexually assaulted a woman in Tweed near where he and his wife owned a cottage. She is only referred to in records as Jane Doe and wasn't able to identify Williams when she reported the attack because she was sleeping when he entered her home, and he woke her up covering her face so that she wouldn't be able to see his face. This woman is, in my opinion, clearly someone that Williams had an infatuation with. He had been watching her because he would return to her home 3 more times in the next 5 days. The day after he raped her, he went back to her home. Thankfully, she wasn't there, but he still broke in. He took pictures of himself wearing her lingerie and then stole some of those items. The following night, he returned again, but chose not to enter the home because Jane Doe's daughter and the father were spotted inside. Williams waited until the 22nd to try once again. This time he broke in, discovered no one was home, so he took, quote, nude photographs of himself wearing one of her thongs. He also stole more clothing, end quote. 2 days later, on September 24th, Williams targeted Lori Mazzucati. He broke into her home while she was away and stole a pair of her underwear. He also returned 2 days later and stole even more clothing. However, the third time he returned to Lori's home, she was there, and he attacked her. He blindfolded her before sexually assaulting her in her home on Cozy Cove Lane near his cottage in Tweed. Because she had been violently woken up and blindfolded before the assault, Lori was unable to identify Williams as the intruder. On October 24, 2009, Williams selected another home to break into, but he quickly left after only taking a few photographs because he discovered that there were no female occupants who lived there. His next target was Marie-France Como, the corporal who had served under his command in the Persian Gulf and now at Base Trenton. She had also served as a military flight attendant once during one of Williams's VIP flights, but that was pretty much the extent of their interactions. Unfortunately for her, that was more than enough for Williams to decide to target her. He broke into her home the first time on November 16, 2009, going about his usual routine of posing in her undergarments for pictures and stealing some of the items. The following night, he targeted a different woman named Marcin Cook and left a note on her computer targeting her and taunting her about the fact that he had broken in and she didn't know. In one home on the computer of a 12-year-old victim, Williams had simply typed "Merci" before he escaped into the night. So now, a week after he first broke into Marie France's home in Trenton, he returned. On the evening of November 23rd, 2009, Williams entered her home and hid behind the furnace in her basement, waiting for her to come home. At one point during the evening, she walked down into the basement looking for her cats before she went to bed, and that's when Williams jumped out from behind the furnace and attacked her. He tied her to a post and put duct tape over her eyes and mouth, and then he took photographs of her, but decided that the lighting in the basement wasn't that great, so he took a break and went upstairs to get a lamp. For the next few hours, Williams recorded a video of him as he tortured Marie France. He raped her, he beat her, he tormented her while taking pictures. Williams later told police that just before he strangled her to death using duct tape that he had wound very tightly around her neck, she begged him not to kill her, saying, quote, "Have a heart. I've been good all of my life. I don't want to die," end quote. According to the video evidence, Williams told her to shut up and then duct taped over her mouth and nose, watching as she suffocated to death. Marie France's body wouldn't be discovered until 2 days later, on November 25th, covered up with a blood-soaked duvet in her bedroom. At the time, police believed this was an isolated incident and not the work of the same man they had been tracking for the home invasions. The autopsy revealed that Marie France had also suffered several debilitating hits to the head, later determined to be from a flashlight that Williams had brought with him. There were also signs that she resisted and fought as hard as she could, and this was also confirmed by the videotape after Williams' arrest. If she resisted him as he raped her, she would be violently beaten. After the discovery of her body, Williams, in the most grotesque fashion, sent Marie France's father a letter of condolences as the commander of the base where his daughter had served. That is just completely sick. He is the one responsible for her death, and he, acting as the base commander, sent a letter consoling her father about the death of his daughter. So gross. A few weeks after this murder, Williams and his wife moved out of their Orleans home and settled in Ottawa. On January 7th, 2010, he was actually interviewed by a local paper, The Intelligencer. So he wasn't shy about being in the view of the public, and I really think that he honestly believed that he was untouchable at this point and that there was no way police would ever catch him, because why would they suspect the base commander? And this made him all the more dangerous. On January 29th at about 1 a.m., Williams struck again, kidnapping Jessica Lloyd and taking her to his cottage in Tweed. He broke into her home in Belleville, Ontario, located along Highway 37, saw that she was sleeping. He woke her up, covered her eyes, and raped her before making her pose for photographs. He then forced her into his silver 2001 Nissan Pathfinder, which he had parked in a field nearby, and then drove her to the cottage. For the next 19 hours, Williams tortured and sexually assaulted Jessica, just like he had done to Marie France, recording a video of the entire attack. He murdered her on the evening of January 29th when he took a flashlight, most likely the same one he used on Marie France, and hit Jessica over the head with it, cracking her skull. He then used a length of rope to strangle her. After he died, Williams carried her body into his garage and kept it there until the night of February 2nd, when he then dumped her body in the woods near Tweed. In the days after her murder, Jessica was reported as a missing person. Police found her car at her home after co-workers became concerned when she had failed to show up for work. By this point, Belleville police, as well as the Ontario Provincial Police, believed that the sexual assaults of Jane Doe and Laurie Mazzucati, the murder of Marie France Como, and now Jessica Lloyd's disappearance were all connected. So they launched a full-scale investigation into locating Jessica, but also to find the person responsible for these attacks before he struck again. What's ironic about this is that Base Trenton, the one that Williams commanded, was asked to be involved in the search and rescue efforts to find Jessica, and Williams himself had to sign off on allowing personnel and military aircraft to be used. The search efforts continued for the next week, but investigators and volunteers were no closer to locating Jessica, but there was a break in the case. Several witnesses reported seeing a silver vehicle parked near Jessica's home on the night of her suspected disappearance, so an analysis of the tire tracks was conducted, which resulted in being able to identify and therefore narrow down the potential vehicle types that may have been in that location. Among the potential vehicles who used that particular type of tire was the same Nissan Pathfinder that Williams drove. To conduct a search of the suspected vehicles, Ontario police set up checkpoints on roads surrounding the crime scene, and on the evening of February 4th, 2010, Williams was driving on Highway 37 when he was stopped at a checkpoint. Under the guise of checking for drunk drivers, officers would ask those in the vehicles if they had heard about Jessica Lloyd, if they knew anything about her disappearance, and then they would also examine the tires if they matched from the track marks. Williams was questioned but told the officer that he was in a hurry because he had a sick child and needed to get home. The officer, of course, recognizing who he was, let him go, but not before noticing that Williams' tires were the same kind as the ones that made the tracks in the field. Oh, and fun fact, Williams and his wife never had any children, so he lied because he knew he was close to getting caught. The hurried interrogation made the officer suspicious of Williams, especially after it was verified that he didn't have children. So he reported the interaction, and because of this, Williams was placed under surveillance. On the afternoon of February 7th, police contacted Williams and asked that he report to the police station because they had a few more questions for him. He obliged, greeting police with a smile and stating, quote, "I have never been in a room like this," end quote, as he sat down in the interrogation room. For the next several hours, 47-year-old Russell Williams was questioned by Detective Sergeant Jim Smythe, who was beginning to be increasingly sure that Williams was their man when he couldn't account for his whereabouts at key times during Jessica's disappearance, and he was also reportedly wearing the same boots as the night he kidnapped her because the boot tread matched prints found in the snow outside her house. While Williams was being questioned, police, under search warrants for both the Tweed Cottage as well as his home in Ottawa, searched each location, providing updates back at the police station. Of course, Williams' wife, Mary Elizabeth, was completely shocked as police went through their home searching for anything that could connect her husband to the crimes. As police uncovered more and more, Williams eventually stopped feigning his lack of involvement and confessed. When he was asked, "All right, so where is she?" referencing Jessica Lloyd, Williams replied with a simple question, "Got a map?" And then he indicated on that map where he had left her body. If you're interested in the entire transcript of this interrogation, I've also included that in my episode notes. It starts off a bit slow, but it's still interesting if you're looking for a bit more information as to the exchange between Detective Sergeant Smythe and Williams. During the search of his homes, police uncovered, quote, his camera, a duffel bag containing a black skullcap, a manual for lockpicking, and boxes and pillowcases stuffed with underwear and lingerie. Hidden in the basement ceiling of the Ottawa house were two computer hard drives containing expertly concealed records of Williams' activities as a sexual predator over a two-year period. Video clips and nearly 3,000 photographs included depictions of the Tweed assaults and the murders of Como and Lloyd. There were also detailed accounts of his break-ins and a meticulously compiled inventory of all the items he had stolen, end quote. When Williams was finally placed under arrest on February 8th, and charged with two counts of first-degree murder for Jessica Lloyd and Marie-France Como, it's no surprise that it shocked literally everyone, the men and women who served with him in the military, his family, his wife, his neighbors, those who knew him in the community. I'm betting even the royal family was shocked and disgusted at what this man had done, because they, too, had trusted him. While awaiting in prison, Williams attempted suicide the first weekend in April by trying to swallow pieces of aluminum foil as well as a cardboard toilet paper roll, but guards were able to stop him from choking to death. Afterwards, he was placed under constant watch to prevent another suicide attempt. On May 6th, his previous victim, Jane Doe, filed a civil lawsuit against him and his wife for $2.5 million. Several other victims, including the family of Jessica Lloyd, followed this lead, and eventually in 2014, most of the lawsuits were settled, but the amounts were undisclosed to the public. Lori Mazzucati also filed a lawsuit against Williams and his wife, as well as the Ontario Provincial Police, citing that they had failed to properly warn residents that a predator was in the area, and for allegedly, quote, suggesting that she had made a false copycat claim when she reported her assault to police, end quote. The suit against the OPP was settled out of court in 2015 for an undisclosed amount, and in 2016, her lawsuit against Williams was settled for $7 million. On May 29th, Williams was officially charged with 92 counts of breaking and entering and theft, and eventually pleaded guilty to all charges on October 18th. He was sentenced to two life sentences for the murders of Marie-France Como and Jessica Lloyd on October 21st, as well as an additional 102 years for the burglary and breaking and entering charges. He wouldn't be eligible for parole under this sentencing until he has done a minimum 25 years behind bars, meaning he could potentially be up for parole in just a few short years, and he was also placed on the sex offender registry. The day after his sentencing, the Canadian Air Force revoked his officer commission and stripped him of his rank. He was officially kicked out of the military on December 10th, 2010. His uniform and decorations were burned and destroyed so that no one would have to wear the uniform of a disgraced officer, as military uniforms in Canada are often reissued after members leave the military. After his arrest, people were not so convinced that Williams's wife had no idea what her husband was up to, despite her adamantly stating that she had no idea. Other sources, including Lori Mazzucati, state that Harriman knew her husband was a predator and failed to inform the police of his quote-unquote illicit conduct. Harriman initiated divorce proceedings after Williams was sentenced, but at one point, she was included in the civil lawsuits filed by her husband's victims. Since his incarceration, David Russell Williams has been serving his time at the maximum security prison located in Port Cartier, Quebec. What confuses people the most with this case is the fact that it seems like Williams began consistently committing these crimes later in life. He was in his mid-40s when he began breaking into homes, and he was 47 when he began sexually assaulting his victims and then committing murder. So, what happened to this man? He had a glowing military record, tons of potential, he was successful, he seemed to have it all, and then he escalated to extreme sexual sadism and murder in a matter of what seems like just a couple of years. He was explicit and extremely detailed in each attack, which most likely goes back to the fact that he was trained by the military. Military members are known for being very detailed, having attention to detail, very precise. He documented each one in what most experts would agree is an attempt to relive the incident, to recreate those feelings of excitement that he would feel as he attacked his victims. While he was being interrogated, Williams confessed that, quote, he became interested in women's underwear in his 20s or 30s, but did not act on it until a few years ago, end quote, meaning in his mid-40s. This type of interest is called a paraphilia, which includes a broad spectrum of abnormal sexual desires and interests, and are primarily something that surfaces at a much younger age than when Williams supposedly claims it did. For instance, with Jerry Brudos, who I covered in one of my first episodes, He showed an interest in wearing women's shoes when he was as young as 5, and his mother's reaction to this inflamed his desire to the point where he became incredibly dangerous and murdered at least 4 women. In Williams's case, it seems more like he had a breaking point. Something pushed him over the edge, and that's when he began acting on this interest, unfortunately with fatal results. It's like he got a taste for it. He became addicted and couldn't resist any longer. Each attack was more dangerous than the last. The impact to the victims escalated with each one. He needed a bigger fix to satiate his urges, and he was able to keep his public life and this dangerous side completely separate, much like someone like John Wayne Gacy, who was also a respected member of the community before he was found to have killed more than 30 boys, or Dennis Rader, who similarly was well-liked in the community before he was discovered to be the BTK killer. That ability to maintain 2 separate lives without any suspicion is what is so terrifying about killers like Williams. That intense control and ability to compartmentalize his dark fetishes and desires from his quote-unquote public face. Williams spent most weeknights in the cottage alone because, according to him, it made life for his wife easier, but he would spend weekends with her, so she most likely wasn't using the same computer as her husband, or perhaps he even forbid her from using it, since that's where he documented each break-in and assault, as well as the photographs and the videos that he took. I, for one, would have been discouraged and frustrated with this kind of setup, with the fact that my husband was rarely home, spending just weekends at home with me. But to each their own, every marriage is different. You do what you have to do to make it work. But this arrangement certainly left Williams with lots of free time on his hands, and he could scope out a new home to break into while he was out for one of his daily jogs. He never had to account for where he was going at night because he was the only one in the home. He solidified himself as a reliable and useful member of society, someone who would never be at the top of a list of potential suspects. He was the kind of man who was invited to drop the puck at local hockey games. He carried the Olympic torch for the torch relay when it came to Belleville as part of the opening ceremonies for the 2010 Winter Olympics in Vancouver. Like I said, he was a very meticulous and extremely organized person, which was part of what made him so dangerous. And it's the reason why his statement at his sentencing rings completely false to me. After learning his fate, Williams said the following, quote, "Your Honor, I stand before you indescribably ashamed. I know the crimes I have committed have traumatized many people. The family and friends of Marie-France Como and Jessica Lloyd in particular have suffered and continue to suffer profound, desperate pain and sorrow as a result of what I've done. My assault of Ms. name has been redacted because of the publication ban, and Ms. Mazzucati have caused them to suffer terribly as well. Numerous victims of the break-in-enters I have committed have been very seriously distressed as a result of my having so invaded their most intimate privacy. My family, Your Honor, has been irreparably damaged. The understandable hatred that was expressed yesterday and that has been palpable throughout the week has me recognize the most will find it impossible to accept. But the fact is, I deeply regret what I have done and the harm I know I have caused to many. I committed despicable crimes, Your Honor, and in the process betrayed my family, my friends and colleagues, and the Canadian force," end quote. Yeah, I don't necessarily believe a single word of that. I think he's ashamed and embarrassed that he got caught, because he would have continued to do this until he was caught. So here's hoping that David Russell Williams never walks a free man and spends the rest of his life behind bars. All right, my friends, that was the case of former Canadian Air Force Colonel David Russell Williams. Thank you so much for listening and for your support and kindness, especially to everyone who reached out while I was taking a bit of a breather. I hope you'll continue to listen each week, and I hope that despite all the craziness that has already been part of 2021, I hope the year is treating you well so far. As always, you can reach out to Mask of Sanity on Instagram, Twitter, and Facebook. My Instagram is Mask of Sanity the Podcast, and Twitter is Mask Sanity Pod. Please don't ever hesitate to offer suggestions, or if you have questions or feedback, any of my social media inboxes or my email, maskofsanitythepodcast@gmail.com, are always open to you. And also a huge thank you to everyone who is a current Patreon supporter and has supported my show either through that or through the merch store or a one-time donation through my Ko-fi account. Your donations, your support has made it possible for me to make another donation to victim services organizations that I will be doing at the end of the month. So any little bit is appreciated in making a difference. If you haven't done yet and you have the means to do so, I'd urge you to consider doing so, because these donations go to helping victims of crimes and making sure that they get the support that they need. Please stick around after the show for the promo trailer for A Few Bad Apples podcast. The show's host, Catherine Sheffield, focuses on shining a light on police crimes, and some of the episodes do contain quite graphic details, so consider yourselves warned. Make sure to subscribe wherever you listen, and also leave her a 5-star rating and review. Thank you all so much for listening, and please join me next week when I cover the case of Robert Black. Until next time, stay safe, friends. Mask of Sanity is partnered with the Oracle Network.
Fact: over 700 people have been killed by the hands of the police just this year alone. I'm Catherine Sheffield, host of the weekly podcast A Few Bad Apples. Each week, I unravel true stories of victims whose lives have been affected by bad apple officers of the law. I bring this relevant conversation into the public spotlight because it's a way to provoke change and reform. Not all officers are bad, and in fact, I highlight a positive story at the end of every episode to balance the spectrum. A Few Bad Apples is available wherever you get your podcasts.